Just like this, ooh wee, feels pretty good to me. Double up with the cone in the butt, please.
That's Cotton Candy Psyop by Hannibal Lace featuring Johnny Pemberton. My names are Duncan Trussell and this is the DTFH. I want to tell you about some shows I got coming up. I'm going to be at Zany's in Rosemont, Illinois. That is September 8th, 9th, and 10th. Also the Tacoma Comedy Club, September 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. Then I'm going to be at Cobb's, after that Helium, then the Spokane Comedy Club, then Wise Guys, then the Comedy Zone. Come see me. You can find tickets at DuncanTrussell.com or just go to the Comedy Club's website. If you would like commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, go no further than patreon.com/DTFH. Subscribe, and you will no longer be plagued by commercials. You'll get sweet, pure, unadulterated, free base DTFH power launched like a heat-seeking missile right into your calcified, stinky pineal gland. That's patreon.com/DTFH. Returning to the DTFH is one of my favorite musicians. I'm sure you are aware of his insane work. Mr. Bill is here with us today. If you're like me and you love making music, you should definitely check out MrBillsTunes.com. I'm signing up for season 5 of The Art of Mr. Bill Ableton Tutorials. He freely dispenses trade secrets of electronic musicians. If you've ever listened to any kind of super psychedelic music and thought, how did he do that? Did he throw a microphone into a hyper-dimensional gargoyle's mouth and record the rumblings of the quantum vacuum within its stomach? No, that's not what he did. Actually, a lot of the things that you hear in that kind of music are very doable. And if you are looking to expand your wheelhouse, if you want to find some more tools when it comes to making music, then definitely check out MrBillsTunes.com. Sign up for season 5. All the links you need to find Mr. Bill or any of my comedy dates or any of the sponsors can be found at DuncanTrussell.com. And now let's jump into this deep, philosophical, and for me, highly inspirational conversation with Bill Day, a.k.a. Mr. Bill. Bill, welcome back to the show. Like I was just saying off mic, I've been obsessed with your music. I've been driving around listening to it, and it is blowing my mind. I think this is the first time I've ever had a vehicle with like a good sound system. And so like now I'm able to like not just listen to it, but like feel it, you know, because it like vibrates your body in a certain way. And I just have to say, man, holy shit. Like, I'm sorry if this is a ridiculous question, but where is that coming from? Like, where is that ability to tune in to a specific frequency that I have only experienced, like when either like dream states or like deep psychedelic experiences? What's your process, man?
So my process is actually like kind of technical. It's not really like emotional, which I think is a downside, and I think it needs to be more that way. But I mean, my process is basically I just open up synths and stuff on my computer, and I just start messing around, or I like will load samples into samplers and just start like mangling them in different ways and just sort of fuck around with shit until I go, oh fuck, that gives me an idea, and then like start writing a beat around it, you know. So usually like it's this kind of like creative accidents that then inspire some sort of idea generation. And I believe that creativity doesn't live in a vacuum at all. I don't feel like any of us like really have original ideas. I feel like everything that we ever think or every idea that we ever have was spawned by the thing that just preceded that, basically, and then that gave us the thought to right. do X, Y, Z. And I feel like if you can kind of generate like interesting randomness, you can basically create like an endless cycle of creativity as long as you have that like that sort of stimuli to just generate you like ideas that you find exciting. And honestly, lately I've been using AI for that a lot. Like I'll train, there's this thing called Dance Diffusion that I've been using a lot lately, and basically you can train a model on a folder of sounds, and it works the same way as Stable Diffusion. So the way Stable Diffusion works is it like will use Gaussian blurring or like basically white noise over and over again on an image, and yeah. then it gets to a point where it eventually goes like, all right, now I know how to get from white noise back to that original image. And the way that the audio version of it works is actually the exact same. It actually still does it with images, but then in the background, once it creates the image of the thing that it was trained on, it uses like a synthesizer to take that MEL spectrogram and get it back to audio. So it's literally just Stable Diffusion with a synthesizer on it.
Wow.
And so I've been wow. training like models and stuff on my music, like just folders and folders of my music. And then it'll just generate like these sort of, because it can only train 3-second chunks right now. So it will generate these like 3-second ideas, and it sounds like you're just flipping through a Mr. Bill radio, basically. And one of them will be like, oh shit, that gives me an idea. And then I'll cut that little bit out and then sort of start building on that and stuff.
I love how inclusive you are in sharing your process, how you're making some of these sounds, you know, because I didn't want to bug you, man, but I was, you know, listening to your music, and I just kept thinking, how the fuck is he making this. I bet it's like a trade secret.
No,
I bet he doesn't. Then it's like you give away every single trick.
Yeah,
it seems like
yeah, pretty much.
But
yeah.
I have to ask, do you hide anything?
No,
is there anything you're like, I'm not putting out? Wow,
I don't. And the reason why is because I think at the end of the day, like at this point of music production, no one is starved for information or starved for like resources, like good quality samples, good quality synthesizer presets, like good quality VST synthesizers at all, which didn't really even exist when I started. And yeah, all the information is on YouTube. All of the software is out there. Like everyone's got access to everything. And so I think the only thing setting people apart at this point is their creativity and their ideas, you know, like their ability to generate an idea. Because everyone literally has the same set of sounds at this point to work with.
You know, I think there's something even before that, which is most people, when they listen to the kind of music that you make, the first thought out of their head isn't, I could do that. That would be easy to make this. I could make something that sounds like someone threw a microphone into a black hole. Like, no problem. So I think that's the first probably obstacle is most people just don't feel like they have what it takes to make music of any kind, much less like something as sophisticated, high tech and intense as what you produce.
Yeah, I feel, yeah, I have that with a lot of things, not with music, obviously, but I have it with like, you know, if I look at some sort of Beeple 3D generated art or something, I'm like, well, that's so crazy. I can never do that. But really, the only thing that's holding me back is just looking into it and just spending like many, many hours just messing around with 3D software and stuff. Like I realistically could, but yeah, there's this mental block, I feel like, that a lot of people put up, and I also put up, where you kind of just like discount the fact that it would be possible for you to do at all for XYZ, whatever justification, you might not even think about it. But like literally, if you just go on the internet and you're driven enough and you just want to make music, like digital electronic music or any music really, like just go to YouTube and type it in. Like all the information is there. It's crazy.
I think this is sort of like part of being human is without even realizing you've done it, you've sort of locked yourself in this tiny little room with this is what I do, and this everything outside of the room is what I don't do. So you might see, like, I don't know, some experiment in quantum entanglement, and you think to yourself, I would never be able to take quantum particles and entangle them. I would never, or you wouldn't even look into like, what does that even mean? Or what is that? What is a qubit? What is that? And then how would I, if I wanted to do like access to something that would let me entangle particles? You would never even get that far. You just block yourself. I'm using a very extreme example, but anyone listening, I'm sure you have a list of things that you think, that's not me. I would never do that.
Well, something like that, for example, like I would think about it for like 2 seconds and go like, you'd probably need a physics degree. You'd probably need to go to like MIT or some shit or whatever. Fuck. And I just put a block up, like it's not happening. But who knows? I mean, I haven't even looked into it. Like maybe if I went online and like went on YouTube, I could start to understand bits of it. And, you know, then that might inspire me to learn more and more of it. And, you know, everything's possible. But yeah, it's definitely... I think that's probably where a lot of people maybe even get stuck, right? It's like the before even trying bit, they just kind of like decide that they can't do it for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's a really like exciting thing just to even realize that about yourself. Like when I got into like just trying to make songs and make music, or even when I got into comedy, pretty much anything that I've gotten into, I never thought, oh, I should do that, or I could do that, or I'll be able to do that. It was always having to overcome like an insane, barely permeable membrane of confusion. I think that's the only way to put it. It's not even self-doubt. It's just confusion or a kind of self-imposed limitation.
Especially when you're getting into a field that's been around for a long time and like so many people have stood on the shoulders of giants to get it where it is today, that it's like to climb up all of those people would just be like insane. So like, for instance, like comedy, right? It's been around for a long time. Music's been around for a long time. it's just very overwhelming, I think, when you first get into it, because it's just so much to learn. And that like initial hump, like that initial learning curve, I think is what holds a lot of people back. I'm curious, when did you get into comedy?
Oh my God. I think it was late-ish 90s, something like that. I just got a job at the Comedy Store working on the phones, and I was going to go to graduate school, didn't want to be a comedian. Mm. It always used like being funny as a way to like deal with social anxiety, you know, or to like just, I think that's a lot of comedians' story is like you sort of develop this defense mechanism. And so I was funny, but like I never thought of doing stand up. And then like, just because you get 3 minutes of stage time, if you worked at the Comedy Store, which in those days seemed like an infinity to me, all the comics who were there is like, why are you here? Like, what are you doing? Like, you're getting no money to work on the phones. Like, the only reason we're here is for the stage time. Like, there's no other reason to do this. They just kind of convinced me to do it. I think they also, I'd made them laugh and they thought it was funny. And so they wanted to see what would happen. Or maybe they just wanted to laugh at me bombing my ass off. I don't know. So it was happenstance. It was happenstance. There was no real plan.
Do you remember?
You know, I think.
Oh, sorry, go on.
No, please.
I was going to say, do you remember like the sort of turning point where you were like, all right, fuck it, I'm a comedian now? And do you remember sort of like how much you had learned up until that point, or like what it was that inspired you to finally go like, all right, that's what I'm doing now?
Yeah. This comedian named Freddie Soto, who sadly passed away a while back, I was like training for the job of the Comedy Store called The Runner, which basically was like Mitzi, the owner's driver. And once you get that job, it's like those stories of like the curses, where the only way you can get out of the curse is to give the curse to somebody else. Because if you quit as the runner and you want to be a comedian, you're not going to be, you risk like being able to have stage time at the store because Mitzi's going to be pissed off. Mm. So the story that every runner in the chain of runners tells the next runner is Mitzi only lets people that she thinks can be successful comedians be the runner. And Mitzi thinks that you have it, kid. Now, this has got to be bullshit. Mitzi never saw me do stand up, but you know, back then you're just like, fuck. She saw the thing that I think could be in me. But the way he did it was really smart. And I had made him laugh really hard. And that meant that when you're like at a comedy club and you make like a successful comedian laugh, it's like, it means the world. Mm-hmm. But I remember, man, I was pumping gas into the van and he just said to me, he's like, Duncan, you know, if you go to graduate school, it's going to take you, how long? 10 years, 12 years. I don't remember what he said. And it's going to be so expensive. But I think if you spent that amount of time focusing on like stand up, you might be able to have that as your job. Hmm. And I just, it's weird, man. It's like time froze. I still remember in my head, like just a little frame of me looking at the gas pump, the like whatever invisible gears behind the watch of time space turned or something, you know, like I shifted into another parallel universe at that moment. I was like, yeah, maybe I will try that. And that was the beginning of it for me. I would say that was when I was like, okay, I'm going to go for it. And, but up until that point I had, what about you? When did you shift into having what a lot of people I think consider to be one of the coolest possible jobs on planet Earth?
So I decided very, very early on that music was going to be my job. Like I decided this when I was like maybe 14 or 15. And at that time I was playing guitar for like 10 hours a day and I was just smoking like hella amounts of weed. So I was just like getting high, playing guitar all day. And I was like, this is fucking cool. If I could just do this all the time, that'd be cool. And so I did that. Then this was around the time that those like bubble looking IMAX were coming out, you know, those ones that look like they like have the colored backs on them.
Know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So my parents got one of those and I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And internet like only got to Australia when I was like 15 years old. So Yeah, I started using this computer. I found this thing on there called GarageBand, and then started messing with it and, you know, just clicking around and recording. Like, I was basically using it as like a loop pedal. I was like recording a layer, and then I would just record another layer over it, another layer, and then just basically like record guitar parts in. So I did that for a few years, and then I met this dude, this kid named Frosty, and he was into like Nine Inch Nails and like all this crazy shit I'd never heard of before, and he knew how to use Fruity Loops. And then he was like, oh, you should like come to this doof with me. A doof is what we call like a psytrance party in Australia. They're kind of like a
cool,
yeah, they just play psytrance for like 3 days straight and everyone's on.
Well, let me just stop you there. If there is, that is the perfect name for a psytrance party, because that, well, yeah, yeah. That, just that articulation pretty much sums up how you feel. Like, duff, what the fuck is this? They're opening parallel dimensions.
I think they call it that because like the music goes duff, 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 duff.
Okay, that's good. Duff.
Yeah. Duff. Dude, Americans have such a hard time saying that too. It's like, it's spelled D-O-O-F, but every time...
Duff.
Yeah, it's pronounced doof, but everyone here says like doff. But anyway, so I went to this doof and took acid for my first time and listened to psytrance all night. And I was like, oh man, this is basically like metal, which is what I was super into at the time, because I really liked all the, right, like how tight metal was and like how like technical it sounded and stuff. And then I heard psytrance whilst on acid and was like, well, this is way more technical and way cleaner and like this is insane.
Yeah,
had no idea like what a DJ was or what the people on stage were even doing, any of that stuff. But then like on the drive home, I was like chatting with my friend and he's like, oh yeah, I know how to do that stuff. I got like Fruity Loops. I've messed around with it a bit. I kind of get the concept. So I hung out with him for a bit and was just messing with FL. And then from there, I decided like maybe after like a year or two of that, I found Ableton. And then about like around that same time, I decided, fuck it, I'm going to go to university and get a degree in audio engineering.
Wow.
And then did that. And then sort of by the time I'd finished university, I was like getting show offers and stuff like that to play small parties around Sydney. And so that's basically how it happened. But the decision was made when I was like 15 to just get it, to just do music. But like the path that it took me on was definitely not what I thought it would be. I thought I would just be in like a band or something. Decision was made when I was like 15 to just get it, to just do music. But like the path that it took me on was definitely not what I thought it would be. I thought I would just be in like a band or something.
Wow, that is, man, that's what I'm talking about. Like the first time I heard I guess it was house that my friend Bobby was a house DJ, and the first time I heard that, I felt the same way about it that I feel about LSD chemists. Like, I could never make that. Like, I don't know who's making this. It's a mysterious thing anyway that anyone is even making it. Like, you know what I mean? It's a mysterious thing. You see these records, they're, you know, with a weird, just like basic white imprint. You know what I mean? Like they look, some of them don't even have like art on them that you know, my friend had picked out from crates or whatever, but the people producing the music for duffs, we called them raves in the old days.
Yeah, same thing basically.
They just seem like these mysterious behind the scenes people, but that you'd never run
into. At the time,
right?
They were.
Yeah, they were.
Like, sharing information was not normal back then. It was definitely like you hold on to your, like when I first started, and that started to phase out pretty quickly when I started. But at the time, it was like you held on to your tricks. You don't share your tricks with anyone. Those two or three tricks that you figured out that you do, like that's what makes your sound, and that's what makes you unique and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, like around the time that I started, or a little bit after, I noticed that this dude Tom Cosm was putting tutorials on YouTube. I was like, This is crazy, like this guy's fucking amazing. And then I was like, that inspired me to do it. And now it's like everyone just shares, and this is why I think electronic music has grown so quickly and so exponentially. Like everyone just shares everything, like sounds, samples, synth presets, like software ideas, everything.
Yeah.
And as a result, it's just grown so quickly. And I feel like that's slightly different in other communities, you know. YouTube, stop showing dunk in your butt.
It's fine. Show me your butt.
Yeah, in like other communities, right? Like say, I don't know if it's like this in comedy, but in other scenes where people are very protective of their information and hold on to it, I feel like they grow a lot less quickly. Like it takes a long time for people to sort of learn everything versus just being completely open source, basically. Like when you open source stuff, I feel like it grows a lot faster.
Sure feels good. Like there's something that just feels delightful about throwing your shit out there and not getting all hung up on the IP. You know, there's something that just feels good about that, just naturally, like instantaneously good. It always feels bad to have to defend or feel like you're protecting something, or, you know, just sacrificing whatever that impulse is to the community. It feels good. It's just cool, man. Like, but you know, with comedy, it's a little different in the sense that it's, you know, jokes themselves are like, you can't share those, you know. It doesn't work. But the sort of like technical aspects of it, that's like the inside baseball talk between comedians that from the outside would probably seem incredibly mundane.
Can you give me an example of like what one of those is?
Yeah, sure. Using the pause, like, you know, like entry level comedians don't realize they're having a conversation with the audience. So like when you first start doing stand-up, I sure didn't, like you just want to tell your jokes and get laughs, but you accidentally dehumanize the audience. You don't realize you're having a conversation with the audience.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's like you have to say the thing and then give them a break as if they will be able to talk back, but instead it's like they just you give them a break, they have the thought in their head about what they would say back or something, or what they think, and then give them more information than they think. Yeah, that makes sense.
And you can't fake it. You actually have to like listen to them, like you're listening. So it's like a conversation. The way it's like one-sided is that the conversation you're having, you will like make a joke and then they will respond with laughter, hopefully. But if you don't like listen, not just for the laughter, but for their energy and for them, they feel the same way anyone feels in a one-sided conversation. And so that can really like, you know, even though your jokes could be good, if the audience has the sense that you're just robotically belting out gags, they're not going to like you as much as if, like, you know, and that's, you know, these are the conversations you just have with comics about like experimentation and that pause and extending the pause too much, or God forbid you tell a joke that you like pause too long because you're expecting laughter or applause or some bullshit. So it's, I guess you could say it's a expectationless pause. You know what I mean? Like if you're expecting this or that, they will sense that too. And so yeah, that's a, you know, you could end up in a conversation with comics just about that aspect of it for days. Anytime you see them, you go back, oh, I tried extending the pause here. That's an example of it. And there's so many others. Like there's so much meta stuff behind stand-up I think it would be pretty like dull for people probably. Like it would just feel like boring to hear us talk about like rearranging the order of jokes, or like holding the microphone, or where you put your leg at certain times, or you know, all the weird ways you can like italicize parts of your act. That's the conversation we do. Like if you're not sharing that as a comedian, like you probably don't have friends.
Yeah, like delivery stuff, I feel like, is definitely super important. I got a question. So I have this premise, right? Because I've thought so many times about getting into stand-up. And
gotta do it.
I would love to, but I don't know how to craft a joke out of my like my premise or idea. So here's like here's an example of a premise, and maybe you can like show me how you would get from that to the to a joke that would make people laugh. All right, so I ordered like a Manscaped razor trimmer thing, and it came with like this lotion, and the lotion was like a moisturizer, right? But it's for your balls. It's called like ball toner or some shit. So I put it on my balls, and then the next time I went to take a piss, I was like, oh shit, my balls like are extremely smooth. So I started using that as facial moisturizer because I was, you know, thought, maybe it'd be good for my skin on my face as well if it's like this good for my balls.
Yeah.
And then the punchline basically is that like somebody calls me a dickhead or something because I put dick shit on my face. I don't know. But like, how would you get from like
a premise? Everything up until the punchline is fantastic.
Okay.
The punchline, no, that is not. See, like, that I get it why you would think that is the punchline, but I think that the way you just told that story is funny. Mm. Like, it's really funny to, and lots of us would think that. You know what I mean? That you could, like, when I look at my balls, until just now, I never even thought there was hope. You know what I mean? Like, I've never looked at my balls and thought, I'm going to make these look better. Like, ever. Like, there's no makeup for balls that I'm aware of. You know what I mean? No, eyeshadow or blush or concealer for balls. So, if I were trying to write a joke about this is a story. That's the main thing. Like, this is a story. Mm. That's what you want. Stories. This is the story of the time you put ball toner on your face. And so what I would do is every single thing I just said, I would try to like flesh out every single aspect of it that is notable or funny. You know what I mean? So that within the story, I could make commentary on lots of different things, specifically that, you know, guys are concerned with the way their balls look.
Mm, okay.
You know what I mean? Which is something for me, I have one ball.
Really?
So for me, like, yeah, I have one ball. I have testicular cancer. Oh, so for me, I've given up on my balls.
Right.
Ball. You know what I mean? Like, I never thought my balls, when I had to, look good. I don't think they look good now. And the idea that, like, people are putting toner on their balls. That's a entryway into lots of observational comedy just about society as a whole.
So at the end, like, you don't really aim to get to a punchline. You just kind of
Oh no, you got to get the punchline. We're just not there yet.
Oh, gotcha.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like you're just throwing out a wide net, and you are trying to discover what am I really saying here? Like, what is this that I'm saying? Like, what the punchline, you need to have lots of punchlines in a story. That's the other thing, is like the final punchline just needs to be funnier than all the previous punchlines. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you can't follow a super funny punchline in a story with a weak punchline. I've made that mistake many times. I've had to abandon like jokes because the beginning of the story was funnier than the end of the story, or just cut them in half. So that's sort of the map that you want to create. And in that kind of cartography, probably a punchline will emerge. We don't know what it is yet, because it would require like lots of sort of
like fleshing walking, it all out.
And then sometimes I'll just walk around just saying the story to myself like a lunatic. You know what I mean? And then suddenly my brain will spit out what could be a punchline. Now, it probably isn't, because this is where comedy becomes a thing of its own. You got to get in front of people now and say that joke that you just fleshed out with whatever you think the punchline is. And in that form of kind of interrogation of the material, you will discover hopefully something. But that's a joke evolves over multiple shows. You know what I mean? You will, whatever you think the punchline is of your joke many times will not be the punchline. It will transform into something completely different via editing, bombing, then editing, doing good, then realizing like, fuck, sometimes it's like just inflection. It's so weird. It's so weird. And so that's why in between specials, you have to spend a year out there developing these fucking things until like you've discovered what it is. But I think I think the premise is wonderful. And I think the way you delivered it is great in this kind of deadpan way. But I think that, yeah, that's the problem with stand-up is you just got to get on stage.
Yeah, also like finding your own style and stuff. I'm curious though, during this like fleshing out period, to find all of the things that are like little punchlines and like all of the things that you can like dig right into to get the most out of the story. Are you doing this like in a text document or like writing it on a pad, or are you just sort of doing this in your head?
Yeah. Well, it depends. Everyone has their own way of doing it. Some people will like the best way to do it is to record and listen back to your material, which I don't like that. I don't like that so much.
Well, part of, I think, laughing at a joke is that it's like unexpected, right? And like something like you don't expect what the next thing's going to be, but it's kind of funnier than what you could have possibly thought of in like 2 seconds, right? So
yeah,
it's kind of, I think that would be difficult because it's none of it would be unexpected, right?
Well, you learn. See, that's the thing. Is like that's the when they talk about comedians finding their voice or whatever. Really, all you've discovered is that you don't need to act like somebody else. That you've been. You know, it's like it really is like the classic spiritual parable of the, you know, person who doesn't know they have like an emerald or a diamond sewn into their clothes. And you know, they've been walking around with a treasure the whole time. They've been looking for the treasure. With stand-up, it's kind of like that. It's like there's just too much latency involved in taking on a persona. It creates just enough latency to not do great.
Wait, what latency are you talking about? Like, what do you mean by latency in that?
Latency, what I mean is like if I'm on stage and I'm thinking about the next thing I'm going to say or what is coming, then that means I'm not in the moment with the audience. So that is going to trigger. And then the same thing when you're talking to somebody and, you know, as a podcaster, that feeling when you realize like they're thinking about what they're about to say. They're not here right now.
Right, right.
And the audience, no one likes that feeling. So anytime I'm on stage and I'm up in my head regarding this or that, whatever it may be, that's a bad sign. That's latency. It's creating an infinitesimally small like error in timing because I'm not fully there. So you have to find a way to be fully there in the moment while telling jokes that you've told many, many times before. So that for everyone it feels new. That's you only get that from the process, from going on stage over and 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 over. And then that starts emerging. Like you start learning how to do that. If you want to do stand-up, you just do it. Like that's all there is to it. Like you don't, because nothing about it makes sense. And nothing in you is going to, If you're a mildly sane, healthy person, you should have infinite reasons to not get in front of a group of strangers and try to make them laugh because it's fucking terrifying. You know what I mean? You'll probably get rejected. It's a confusing situation that you can only learn from repetition. There's all these reasons that your mind will present to you of why. Generally, the procrastination is what keeps people from going on stage, and they don't even realize they're procrastinating, but they are because they're writing. So a lot of comedians fall into this terrible trap, a lot of people who want to be comedians, which is they will fill notebooks up with jokes and thinking at some point I'm going to write the perfect joke And that way, when I get on stage, I'll be safe.
Mm.
And that is just never going to happen, because the joke, you can't write a perfect stand-up joke. You have to grow it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, you know, the attention of the audience is to a joke what sunlight is to a plant. You know, the attention of the audience is to a joke what sunlight is to a plant. And like, it's just not going to happen. There's no way to evade the feeling
right.
of driving but home.
I feel like I would want to get at least at least like a 2 to 4 minute, like decent, like at least like no. have some sort of direction with it, you know, not just go up like with what I got currently without thinking about
well,
it.
You got a direction. You have a pretty good ball toner joke.
Yeah, true.
So that's enough. And also the other thing is everyone has a story. Like you just, all you need to do is think about the story you've told your friends multiple times that they pretend you haven't told them multiple times because they know you like telling it.
Right.
That's your joke.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And then you go with that because you've already worked it out in front of your friends via multiple ear beatings. So start with that. You know, the guy I was talking about earlier, man, like he gave me the only bit of comedy advice that I think is worthy. Cause other than get on stage, which is for the first year of stand-up, don't worry about being funny. Worry about being comfortable on stage.
Mm. Already comfortable on stage because like I've been on stage a lot, like not doing comedy, but I've been on stage in front of lots of people lots of times. And I don't think, and actually not only for DJing, like I've taught a lot, right? So I've taught a lot of classes to like, you know, 50, 100 people, but I'm just like talking about Ableton, but I'm like pretty comfortable with that. Do you think it's like not even comparable or is it like somewhat similar?
No, comparable. Okay. I think that's an advantage. It isn't. The reason that, you know, for one, like, man, when I watch you guys do your thing up there, when it's real, you know, and like the amount of plates that are spinning, the amount of things that could theoretically go horrifically awry, it's shocking to me. It's shocking. Like, how are you doing that?
It's a lot of preparation. Like right now, for instance, I'm building my set for Lost Lands, which is this big festival in Ohio that's thrown by Excision, and it's crazy. It's like a 40,000 person festival. I'm really stoked to be playing.
Jesus.
And it's on September 22nd, and I've been preparing for it already for like a month. So it's like, basically what I'll do is I'll get like a big Ableton session. I'll put every track in it that I want to play. Actually, you saw that video that I posted yesterday, the Cotton Candy asshole mashup.
Yes, thank you, by the way.
Yeah, so you could see how it was like a bunch of like stuff edited together to make that. That's basically like how I make an entire hour set. So it's just a giant Ableton session that sort of starts up the top left corner and just works its way down this way and like edits stuff all together. And then I'll like kind of render it out as like multi-tracks almost. And then when I'm playing, it's really just about hitting the cues on time and just remembering what goes where.
Horrible.
But I feel like less can go wrong there because it's so pre-planned.
No! Are you kidding? Everything can go fucking wrong. There's nothing more jarring and like obscene, especially at like a festival of note, than when a DJ fucks up. Like that's like, it's like the whole festival slams into a wall or something, you know, it's like crazy. True. You can't believe it. You're shocked. What the fuck?
At the end of the day, though, you have to get comfortable with just being at the whim of technology. And I mean, it's sometimes shit fucks up and there's nothing you can do about it. And I don't know. I try to just worry about the shit I can control, which is why I start preparing really long in advance and then just go, all right, so for the best, everything might fuck up, but whatever.
That's it. What you just said is it. That's it. That's the energy to go on stage with. That. you know, you're excited, you've prepared, but also you've surrendered to the reality of chaos. And that's where I think you will feel comfortable up there. Mm-hmm. I think something we have in common sort of is that I feel like there's like people who think not everybody should podcast, not everybody should do stand up, not everybody should do music, not everyone should try to publish or get in front of people. I feel like everyone should throw to do, like, at least make the attempt, because there's something so, like, you already win. I mean, with stand up, or I imagine being a DJ or a musician, like, if you've overcome the maybe genetic terror involved in getting in front of your tribe and like potentially being rejected, you've already won. Like, you've already overcome something that keeps so many people inside, you know? So I feel like it's an automatic win. It's great. I think you should do, anyone listening, if you feel compelled to do stand up, just do it. Like,
yeah, maybe I'll make it a goal to try and do it by like the end of this year or something. Maybe,
you know, man, I'm going to be an asshole here. I'll tell you what you do. You don't do end of the year. That's ridiculous. What you do is you find out where the open mic is, and there's plenty in Atlanta. I could definitely figure out, and people listening to this will tell you from Atlanta where to go, and they will want you to go there probably, because that would be badass to have you do your first stand-up set at their show. And you just go, and you get on stage, and you tell whatever you think 5 minutes of jokes looks like, and that's it. And you don't think about it. It's like jumping in cold water. The more you think about it, the less likely you are to do it. You just do it.
Yeah, makes sense.
That's the only way to do it. Otherwise, you'll never do it. Because the end of the year, you'll be like, oh, I didn't do that. And then you'll never do it. So I would say by the end of next week, you should make it your goal.
Yeah.
Or whenever this comes out, people will reach out to you, I'm sure, from Atlanta.
Yeah, if someone from Atlanta is listening and sends me a link to a stand-up night, I'll try. I'll go. I'll just do it.
You just go. Yep. You just go. And then you'll be so glad you did. Like, even if it doesn't go well, and why would it go perfectly?
Right.
I mean, this is a thing people spend decades learning how to do. So why would it go perfect? So the weight's off of you anyway. It's like, what? You're going to get out there and be Richard Pryor?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? No. But if you can just get out there and be there in the moment, ooh, that's pretty fucking cool, man. And also, and then you'll have this interesting parallel. Like, you'll you know what I mean? Like, you'll have this way of like comparing that world and the world of stand-up.
Yeah, I feel like have the skill of both farming crowd reactions from an EDM crowd and farming laughs from like a comedy audience, and you somehow combine those, that'd be probably pretty top tier.
All right, well, let me ask you this. When you are in front of 40,000 people.
I'm going to be playing the second stage, so I'll be probably in front of like 5,000 or something.
Oh, just 5,000. Okay, so you're only in front of 5,000 people. Do you feel them? Do you feel their energy?
Yeah, totally. And you very much feel it when they're not, well, not that they're not interested, but you feel it when, so I don't know, there's like, the weird thing about music is you can be enjoying it to like the fullest amount that you possibly enjoy music to and expecting no outward reaction at all, right? And this is like obviously what would probably happen to something like, you know, down tempo, like IDM, glitchy, ambient stuff. And I find it really hard to play those sets for this reason, because it's like really hard to tell whether or not people are enjoying it. So
yeah.
My goal usually is to just like farm outward like expressive reactions from people by just doing like the heaviest shit and make it really expected and formatted to a point where, like, because there's like a level of trust I feel like that goes on in a DJ set where it's like, you know, after I signal this that something really cool is going to happen, and you teach them that in like the first 10 minutes, and then they kind of know that that's going to happen for the rest of it. And then like once you're like 30 minutes into it, then you can start to fuck with that format and be like, all right, I'm signaling that this is going to happen, but then there's like a fake out or like something weird. And
that's it, you got it. So there you go, that's it. You do understand it. That's it. It's like it you're basically trying to like harmonize everyone. Like you're tuning them in to a specific frequency, and there's a tangible feeling, which is, I don't know, like I it feels like when you're pushing a balloon or something, like it's like there's some kind of like expansive, very very barely there something that you're, there's a push and pull happening between you and the audience. You can feel that, you feel it. And I don't know what that is, but you know, underneath the jokes and in stand-up, like there's this wonderful feeling that of almost like a membrane or something that you're like tickling or pushing against or working with. That's how you know it's going right, is if you feel that. When the bubble pops and you don't feel that, something's off, man. The connection is broken. There's no, you haven't done the job. You haven't tuned in. And so once you know, if you know that feeling, then yeah, I think you could do, you could pull off.
I feel like I can definitely feel when people are like engaged and when I feel like they're getting bored. And I know when they feel like they're getting bored, because I feel like I'm getting bored. Like sometimes I'll build a set and I'll be like, oh yeah, you know, I want to like indulge in myself for a second because this is a new tune, and play out this like fucking 64 bar techno bit or something. And I'll do it live. And then I'll be like, oh, this is actually just self-indulgent. I'm bored. No one's enjoying it. Like,
it's the worst. I've done it. Every comic has done it. You go through a self-indulgent as you're learning how to do it inevitably. And this is a sand trap. And I imagine it happens with music producers. The sand trap
is you convince yourself that it's like artistically
sophisticated.
Yeah, exactly.
You feel like you're being so fucking sophisticated. Mm-hmm. But really the reality is... at least in stand-up, it is so much easier to not write jokes. It's so much easier to just sort of like, I don't know, like grandstand or like, you know, tell some half-assed, unthought-out thing or and imagine like, this is like Hicks, or you know what I mean? This is like, it's like, no, you're not fucking Bill Hicks. You're you. And they don't like what you're saying because they're not laughing. And that is not a critique of anyone other than me, because I've done that. And it does not feel good, man. It does not feel good.
Yeah, I've done the same shit. And like, I've had the same thought too, where I'm like, oh, it's just too intelligent for them, or I just want to play out this extra little bit of shit because that's my artistic choice or like whatever. But it's like, at the end of the day, you have to recognize that you're playing at a fucking party, and the goal of everyone coming is to like go off and have a good time, and the goal of you as the DJ should be to also enjoy yourself, obviously, and make that, like, facilitate that. And yeah, same with the comedy show, right? It's like you could go in there with the thought that this is like some sophisticated like technical story I'm teaching them, like about comedy in this weird esoteric way, or you could just be like, the idea here is to farm fucking laughs out of these people, and that's what they came here to do. That's what I'm here to make them do.
Very simple.
Yeah, exactly.
No brainer. Don't you, like, you know, unless you have a legitimate artistic impulse to aggressively upset your audience, unless that is truly your calling. And like, there are examples of this, Andy Kaufman being the classic. I heard one of his acts, he would go on stage, assemble a drum set in front of the audience, not talking. He's forcing this audience to watch him assemble a drum set. And I don't think he was like doing like physical comedy while he set it up. You know what I mean? He was like seriously trying to assemble a drum set. And then finally it's assembled. And the next part of his act is he disassembles the drum set and gets off stage. But he was wanting to invoke an awkward, frustrated energy, and in that case it's good. That's his expression, that's conceptual
was
comedy.
This guy, like, previously before doing that, like a stand-up comedy, who would just do normal jokes and stuff?
No,
and then were people coming like with the idea that they're gonna see a comedy show, or
You're not familiar with Andy Kaufman?
No, I'm not.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for you. Oh my God. He was the original troll. And he was
Andy Kaufman.
Andy Kaufman. He was on Taxi. Okay. Like, here's how hardcore this guy was. While he was on Taxi.
What is
this,
Taxi?
Like, hit show. Oh, he was on this hit show. While he was on this hit show, when it meant something to be on a TV show, when it was like if you were on a TV show, holy fuck, man. These days it's like it has less of a less meaning. Though some. He was a busboy. So like he had a side job as a busboy while he was on this like hit show. And he was doing that as a form of like, I don't know what, but I like to fantasize it was like a kind of like act, you know. He got into wrestling. He would wrestle women on stage. Like he would antagonize, like by getting into wrestling, he would take on this persona of like a Hollywood snob in front of like wrestling fans and shoot these hilarious videos antagonizing them like in front of his pool. Like, I'm out here in California law. You people wouldn't even understand what this life is like. Just to create, to be a villain. And he would commit fully to all of these gags, almost to the point where some people wondered if he was like all there mentally, because he was so engaged in like doing this that it was confusing for people. Yeah. And so I'm just saying there's for every rule in comedy, you need a punchline. You got to do this or that. There's examples of people successfully breaking that rule. And that's what's so beautiful about it is it's like they're and frustrating for people is that it's like it's a very slippery fish and it will not allow you to shove it into some grid of rules. Like you could try. Maybe it'll work for you to shove it into a grid of rules. I just was giving you rules, but also
you gotta learn the rules before you can break them as well. You know, it's like there's always an exception to the rule, right? Like there's people out there who can go and play down tempo sets and, you know, 10,000 people will come out to see him, like Tipper, but he's definitely the exception. And he also like never posts on social media. And like, you could look at his career and be like, I'm never going to post on social media and I'm going to do down tempo sets. And that's what Tipper did. And he's massive. It's like, yeah, but he's fucking Tipper. Like no one else in the history of electronic music has done that strategy and like how to work out for
him. Yeah. And that, you know, I think that is like the trick. Liberate yourself, free yourself of trying to be someone else. We got Tipper. He's incredible. We have our Tipper. We don't need another Tipper. We need a you. Whatever it is you do, that's what we need. We need you, not you imitating someone. Though, you know, initially, like, you know, imitating someone, we all do it. You're going to do that. You're going to be influenced by someone, and that's going to sort of define the way that you, like, construct your initial, like, set or whatever it is that you're doing, you know? But then over time, all that stuff falls away because all you have left is you. And that's where it gets great. That's where it gets wonderful. Maybe that's a little scary because if you come out as yourself and that is rejected, then you can't be like, ah, well, I was trying to be someone else and they rejected me. That's you.
Yeah, it's a little tougher if you're like actually trying to do something and fail at it versus just being like, oh, fuck it, I wasn't trying or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I love that we're talking about comedy. It's ridiculous. Your fans are like so mad right now. I want to ask you something, and sorry if this just sounds so bizarre, but do you ever, like, when you're working on stuff, you ever creep yourself out? Like, your music isn't creepy, but I mean, this, initially we were talking about the chaos factor, the random factor, the discovery of something. Do you ever have, like, moments of, like, I don't know, like, feeling like you've connected with something else other than you, or that something is coming through you, or, you know what I mean? A sense of, I'm just saying, sometimes when I'm fiddling around with my modular synthesizers, like, every once in a while, they'll just start making sounds that I didn't intend. And it's not a bad form of being creeped out, but it is a sense of, like, awe, or, like, the same feeling I get when I'm thinking about a friend and they call me, a feeling of, like, shit, man, I just kind of stepped outside of default reality, or, like, something else is in the room.
So one thing that happens to me, like, really often, like, this happens about, like, at least once a month, is I get, like, incredibly deep deja vu whilst working on music. Like, I just feel like I've done this exact thing before, and it is because I've done this exact thing before, but it, like, I don't know, it just gives me, like, really heavy deja vu. And I, yeah, every now and then I'll have this, these, like, feelings where I'm like, like, yeah, where something happens and it just works really well and everything's falling into place, and I'm just like, fuck, yeah, this is, like, just work. Like, I don't really feel like I'm trying here, you know, like, it's just happening. I definitely have that sometimes, but I never really question it that much, to be honest. Like, whenever I'm sort of in the zone working like that, I'm just like, music, music, music. Like, there's nothing really, I'm not thinking about a lot of stuff. And honestly, that is, like, in my opinion, like, the pinnacle of human experience, is like when you're just fully engaged in something and you're not compelled at all to think about anything else outside of that thing. Like, when you're just entirely 100% focused in the moment on one thing. I fucking love shit like that. And that's why I fell in love, I think, so much with mountain biking, because you have to be exactly 100% in the moment. Like, the cost of not is large. So,
okay, let's talk about it, because what, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I remember the first time I felt it, years and years and years ago, trying to make something with my computer. And I remember looking up and realizing, like, 6 hours had passed. And I wasn't there. Like, I was just making this thing. But whatever I thought of as me was gone. And for some reason, maybe this is the difference between you and me, that didn't feel good. It was a little scary. It was like I had been pulled into some kind of weird creative gravity well that I couldn't get out of for 6 hours. I didn't want to get out of, but I was gone. And, you know, now when I get that feeling, I like it. And I am in love with that feeling. But there's still something disconcerting about it.
What is it that's disconcerting about being that focused and that into something?
I mean, it could just be a personal neurosis. Like, I don't think it's bad, but maybe it's because it's like death
or something.
Is
it like the loss of control, maybe? Where you're like, I didn't have the choice really to be like that driven into this thing for 6 hours, and that bothers me that I, like, maybe couldn't have pulled myself away from it?
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe because sometimes when I know I'm about to start working on a song for the podcast, when I know I'm about to start writing, when I know I'm about to start working on something, I have this moment of like, if you start this, you're going to look up and a bunch of hours have passed. And I'll try to trick myself like, no, this is just going to be some stupid little jingle or some shit that is meaningless. And I'll know, no, you know that never happens. You know that that's going to lead to something else. It leads to something else. It leads to something else. It leads to watching one of your YouTube tutorials that leads to, you know what I mean, a research mission that leads this and that and that and that. And there's something about that that's just, I don't know, man. It's a little bit like when you push your raft into the rapids or something. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to have to go down river, man.
That's my favorite thing to do, man. That's literally my favorite thing in the world. And that's what I try to do every day if I can. Like, if I'm doing some boring shit like emails or whatever, it's whatever. I don't really enjoy that too much, but it's part of the job. But yeah, that's my favorite thing to do, is go like, all right, I'm going to do this thing and just like see where I end up. And then I'll just do that all day until I basically got no energy left and decide I need to go to sleep, and have just been through like some aggressive, like, traverse of software and the internet and then come out the other end with maybe a piece of art or something. Yeah, it kind of is, you know, if you put it that way. But I mean, yeah, I haven't found any experience in life that's better than that, you know. Like, I get it also with like Lego. Like, if I sit down to do a Lego set or something and I'm just, you know, so focused on getting this thing finished, and then 2 or 3 hours later I got this thing, and I'll go like, all right, it's done. And then like think about it and you're like, fuck, I was like super like into that thing for just many, many hours. It's like the opposite of boredom, basically.
Yeah, well, but it's there. Don't you think there's something annihilatory about it?
In what way? What are you annihilating?
You're gone. Like, you know, like you're not there anymore. Like, you're gone. Like, you, I mean, you by most standard definitions of you, like in that intense focus, there isn't room for self-reflection. There isn't room for the story of your life or your worries or this or that or all the things that people use to define themselves as a thing. It's gone. Mm. It's like there's a kind of beautiful oblivion or something in it.
Yeah, it's like some ignorance is bliss type stuff or something. But I mean, I don't know. So we're stuck in this human condition. There's no getting out of it unless you kill yourself. We have a bunch of hours to use up in whatever ways we choose, and hopefully we do it without hurting anybody, and hopefully we enjoy them. So I mean, if you enjoy that amount of hours, you know, and you aren't hurting anyone doing it, or no one's losing anything because of you doing it, and in fact, I mean, in a lot of the times they gain something, right? Like if you go super deep on a joke or whatever, and at the other end comes out a podcast or a joke that gets put in a stand-up routine. Like, I don't see anything negative about any of that.
I don't see anything negative about it at all. I mean, again, like, we wouldn't be doing what we do if we saw anything negative about it. But I just find it to be like a somehow an easily overlooked state of consciousness. You know what I mean? It's like, because the sort of, a bit, like, if you're in that state and you're thinking about the state, you're not in the state,
you know,
you're out of the state because you're thinking about the state. Like it's a singularity or something, you know. You can't get data out of a black hole. You can't, it's something else, which is, and I think it's a mystical state. And, you know, and I like that you have a kind of very simple way of describing what you do. But for those of us on the other side, listening to your music, when our faces are melting and we're like, oh, there's that sound. What, he's made the sound I hear on 200 micrograms of acid. You know what I mean? There's that sound where you're like, oh, I remember that sound. I know what that is. And so, you know, that maybe we just project on your music.
I think so, because it's like that old Japanese cone of like, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, doesn't make a sound. You know, music exists in the brain. It doesn't exist in anywhere else, you know. Like, so, and you can prove that because, like, sound, like physical sound as a wavefront, exists, like, regardless of humans. And, like, white noise playing at 100 decibels, or the sound of an aeroplane or a lawnmower, they're all the same thing as music, right? They're sounds. They're just wavefronts of pressure that get hit by our ears and then transferred into our brain as information. But some of it we pass as like, that's a lawnmower, or that's a plane, or that's my cat meowing or something. But some of it we pass as like, this is some like romantic, incredible, like insane thing that's making me feel an emotion right now. So I don't know, like, I don't really attribute the anything to the music so much. It's definitely a interpersonal experience. And I actually made a whole album about this called Apophenia, because I was like, people are gonna just, like, I was thinking about making a concept album, and I thought about it for months, and I was like, oh, what should I call this album? You know, what's it about? What's the meaning of all of this? And at the end of the day, I was like, fuck it, man. People are going to listen to it. They're going to have their own experience with it. They're going to think I meant whatever I meant. They're going to make up their own shit about it, basically. So I was just like, yeah. Fuck it. I'll just call it apophenia, which is basically humans, yeah. Making apophenia is like where you make connections between just completely unrelated things. Like, you know, for instance, Jim Carrey in that movie Number 23 or whatever, or when you look at like an exhaust pipe of a car and see a face in it or whatever, you know, like that kind of stuff.
The Shining movie, that documentary on The Shining, there's some apophenia happening with The Shining, which is there's so many people who have all these different, who see all these different things within it that might be there or might not be there. But I mean, this is like, apophenia is what brings one's sense of self into existence. Like, we literally have existential apophenia. If you exist as a person, to exist as a person, you have to pick out of the infinite number of experiences any human has had by a certain age, you pick out a terribly small percentage of those experiences. And that's you. That's what you say you are. You've forgotten all the, you remember the lawnmower, you forgot the bird, the squirrel, the breakfast, the weird look the guy at the grocery store gave you, or you remember the weird look and you forget the person who smiled at you or whatever. And that's, you just instantly weave that together into a sense of self.
Yeah, I mean, making connections between things is obviously really important for survival. Like, we need to remember where the berries are and remember if they're black, they're bad, and if they're red, they're good, or whatever, you know? So that's like all stuff that like we need to do. But I think that seeps over into, you know, other things like art, or, you know, numbers, numerology, like all this kind of stuff where we,
tarot.
Yeah, exactly. Where we start being like, all right, this like reminds me of this, and that connects this and that, and like it's the evolution thing that like your brain's supposed to do so you stay alive, but it's like just connecting to all this other shit and people are playing into it. I don't know, maybe not. I mean, after actually, I think it was after.
You're not, so you're basically, you're saying you're not channeling black holes. Is that what you're saying? Like in the moment, I'm like, shit, is he tuning into some kind of motherfucking like a ripple in time space? What is this?
No, I think,
like,
I think dear, you're tuning into black holes, right?
Well, I guess you could say that. I want to ask you, do you have a little bit more time? We're already over.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, as long as you want.
I want to ask you about bass. Like, what? Why, to me, like, I don't know, are you familiar with the band Ohm? It's kind of like sludge dude,
is it metal? Yeah.
It's real simple, but the bass, like, something about the simplicity and the bass itself produces like this mystical resonance or something that I don't really experience with other forms of music that I love. Like, there's something about that that is completely unique experientially. And I'm just wondering, do you have any theories on that? Have you spent much time thinking about that? I mean, contemplating like the like why bass drones, wobbles, warps at a certain frequency, hit so hard?
Yeah, so there's a few reasons. The first reason is because it is just a bigger wavefront. Like, if you play like really high frequency, like, you know, 20,000 kilohertz or whatever, it's like this minuscule fucking thing that's like vibrating really small in the air and travels like extremely quickly, right? But bass, like 30 hertz, right? A 30 hertz sine wave or a 30 hertz like sub frequency, it takes about like 20 meters for that just to propagate in one full cycle.
Wow.
So like, you know, when you see a, wow, like a sine wave, right? Like a up and
yeah.
That like 30 hertz just to complete one cycle takes like 12 meters or something.
Wow.
So it's just this massive like wave front, this massive like pressure front that, yeah, bodies just react strangely to, because I guess in the past, or like, you know, historically, anything that's like putting out that much pressure is obviously probably going to be massive, like a dinosaur or something, or a giant tree falling and hitting the ground, like the only things that output.
Meteor.
Yeah, exactly. So I think like by default, it's just built into us for our bodies to just like kind of cringe at that and be like, what the fuck's going on? Like, so I think a bass has that effect, especially when you're at a show with like a fucking giant sound system and it's just putting out like all the way down to 20 hertz. And not only that, but you're also standing 50 meters away from it, so you're copying like the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think like at that point, yeah, your brain just starts to do backflips and go like, fuck, something's crazy is going on right now.
Well, yeah, you know, I'd have to look it up, but I it's one of the theories on haunted houses. You ever seen that? It's a theory. There's like cool theories on like why the experience of a haunted house. One of them is like, I think carbon monoxide. Like they found like that houses that people say are haunted have like carbon monoxide in them,
sense.
And that like your poor body is just like the way it's trying to. It's like, okay, like I don't know how to tell this asshole that they're breathing poison, so let's just make them think there's a ghost here.
Yeah, I'll start showing them like weird images so they get scared and run away.
Yeah, and the other theory is that some of these houses like it have like super low frequencies for whatever reason moving through them, and that those low frequencies are creeping people out. That there's a somehow like a deep. It might be inaudible, but it is affecting them.
If you go into Ableton and you have really, really good speakers and you go into the preferences, you can turn on a test tone and it just puts out a sine wave at whatever frequency you want, at whatever level you want. And if you put that down to like, you know, 20 hertz and you turn it up a lot, it does feel really weird if you sit in front of it for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, That's what I'm saying, man. Like there's something about it that just compared to other frequencies of music, it has a kind of sinister or heavy or like powerful. I don't know, whatever. I don't mean to like paint it as bad, because I love it.
Yeah, it's just, but it's like epic. Like a lot
epic.
Of sutters. Yeah, it makes it, that's the feeling I get from it. It's just like, it's a what the fuck kind of feeling.
Okay, so last thing I wanted to ask you about, and again, man, I'm sorry, you know, like so many comedians love music and we're infatuated with musicians and we just get caught by it. So I'm sorry.
I love chatting with you, man. Like anything you want to ask, anything, like literally.
Thank you.
Text me whenever you got questions. Like I'm always happy to hear from you. And actually, one of my friends hit me up recently and he sent me a photo of someone in an airport and he was like, is this Duncan? And I was like, yeah, I think it is. And he was like, oh, cool. And I was like, you should say hi to him. He's a nice guy. Did he say hi to you? He said he did. And then he said he'll hit you up or whatever. Was he lying to me? Cause he definitely was like, it was definitely you.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember. But yeah, I hope he did say hi. God, that would suck if he didn't.
Yeah, it was
like, what am I gonna do? Get the fuck away from me!
It was literally, let me see if I can find it and show it to you and you can maybe confirm if it was you.
I'll tell you where I was at.
Okay, one sec. It's like,
let me see.
Yeah, dude, it's literally you. Fuck, you can barely see that. Here, hold on.
Text it to me.
Yeah, I will. All right, here.
Here we go, let's see. Better be me.
I'm like almost certain. If it's not, it looks like
last thing I need is a doppelganger.
It looks very much like you.
Let me see.
All right, I just texted it. Yeah, I just texted it to you.
No, that's Brad Pitt. I'm just kidding. Hang on. Let me look. No, I think that's some kind of supermodel. Hold on. Let me look a little closer here. Hold on. Didn't come through yet because I have my phone in airplane. Oh, wait, here it is. That's me.
It is you.
Yeah, that's definitely me.
Yeah, so
for sure.
And he didn't say hi to you. What a cunt. He said he did.
He may have. I might not remember it.
His name was Michael.
Yeah, I have a really weak, shitty memory.
Me too. So, and Michael, I think it's got to do with the fact that, like, when you meet so many people, it's just you can't hang on to them all. Or your brain, if you meet someone in passing like that, it's like your brain just immediately goes, like, that's not really important information. I'm not going to take up bandwidth for that.
I have a fantasy that there's people who go to an airport and they aren't freaked out. Like, I have this fantasy. They exist. There's people who on the way to the airport feel great, in the airport feel great, getting on the plane feel great, all the way through. There isn't within them a kind of cyclone of anxiety. I am not one of those people. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's my parents. You know, I don't know if your parents freaked out in the airport. My parents did. They were always in a hurry. But I hate it. I hate the airport experience. So probably whatever part of my brain might normally remember meeting your friend was gone. Mm. As I'm just sort of like hoping I get on the fucking plane and the plane doesn't get delayed and I'm able to get to my show in time. But
yeah, I told him like four or five, like he was like, no, I'm not going to say hi. And I was like, dude, you got to say hi to Duncan. He's like the nicest guy. And he's like, no, I don't want to bother him. And I was like, trust me, dude. He's like the most open guy. Like
if you guys could see the picture he sent, I'm definitely not busy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like looking at Instagram. Okay. Here's my question for you. DJ or music producer, DJ, whatever you want to call it, as mouthpiece of the underground or the culture of the underground. In other words, like sometimes when I'm at a good show, what did you call them? Duffs?
Duffs, yeah, like raves.
Raves. Sometimes and it's been a while, I got kids now, so it's not like I'm going to raves all the damn time. Burning Man, whatever. There's a feeling that the DJ is voicing this aesthetic that is underground, if that makes sense. That coming out of the speakers is some kind of sound or lyrics or whatever that is articulating a specific moment that's happening in whatever the reality tunnel that I would think of as the underground, and in the sense the not gen pop, not it has yet to be co-opted by a brand, that it is there's a purity to this. And I hear that in your music sometimes. And again, I'm fine with this. These are my own projections, but what about that? Do you feel like that? Do you feel like sometimes you're voicing a sort of secret consensus? That I don't mean like some deep philosophical message or anything like that, but just a general aesthetic that maybe a lot of people aren't even aware it exists.
Yeah, so I think like a lot of producers, including myself, we try to ride the line between stuff that is like already very accepted in pop music, like the same kind of structures, the same kind of melodic routine, the same sort of rhythms, all of that kind of stuff. But we try to ride the line as to like how experimental and unhinged we can get with it whilst still having it be music that like anyone can understand, you know? And I feel like that's kind of what like underground stuff is. It's like how far you can go to the edge without it being like just noise or whatever or crazy shit. And especially in a DJ set, I mean, it kind of is like people are trying to dig for like the rare dub plates and shit all the time, so it kind of is underground, you know, like you're trying to put together basically an hour of stuff that people haven't really heard but is like that they're going to accept because it follows all the norms and structures that regular music does but has these kind of like twists and turns that you wouldn't expect within it. I don't think like I personally don't consciously do that, but what I do consciously do is like sit there and listen to stuff and be like, is this lame? Is this cool? How do I feel about this? And like, think about how I feel about stuff a lot. And I feel like just the stuff that I generally gravitate towards potentially maybe just has that sound to it to some degree. But yeah, it's definitely, I think, a mixture of things. And generally though, for me, I'm always trying to sort of ride the line between like what is popular and what is like what I think is really cool.
Amazing. Bill, I love podcasting with you, man. And I got to say, and obviously you did not ask me to do this, man, your tutorials have helped me so much. They really demystify stuff that I was imagining was like over, like way outside of my pay grade. You know, but I know Ableton, like I've been using Ableton for years. I'm not saying that like it's not like you need to know how to use Ableton and stuff, but I just want people to know if you're interested in making this kind of music, that you're an incredible resource, man. And you're giving out so much free stuff, like just free tutorials and stuff. But I'm interested. I was going to like secretly sign up for one of your, like one of the classes you put out.
Oh, I'll give you access, man. Like if you make,
No. If I do it, you'll never know. I don't want you to do that, but I'm curious. What you would recommend is like the best way, because you have so much at this point. I was like going through it, trying to figure out where do I need to start?
Okay. So I have a website. The website is MrBillsTunes.com, and I've had it for like 10 years, and I've basically been updating it pretty regularly with tutorials and courses and sample packs and project files and stuff like that. And they all have sort of different uses, but I think if you're just starting, the best place to begin is by watching probably my latest series, which is The Art of Mr. Bill Season 5. So there's four of these, and each one of them goes for like 30 or 40 hours, but they're broken up into short videos.
Sorry to cut you off. They don't build on each other? Because that was my confusion. It's like, do I need to? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I start from scratch, and then over that 35 hours, I build a song.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, man. I mean, like when I was going through your website, I was thinking, do I start with Season 1? And then that's going to build to Season 2, which will build to Season 3.
No. So Season 1 is a track from start to finish. Season 2 is a track from start to finish. Like they're all a different track each season.
Cool.
And I do one every like 4 or 5 years or every 3 years or something like that. So like I've got a bunch of new techniques basically every time. So they all have different techniques and stuff in them, but it's all just me building a track from start to finish. Cause I find like a lot of the stuff online is like tricks, right? It's like, here's how to do this crazy one trick or whatever. And knowing that trick is like cool and interesting, but it's only like one thing to add to an arsenal.
Yes.
And really it doesn't, and none of it makes sense unless you incorporate it all into a process, which eventually like gets you to the end of a song, assuming that that's what you want to be doing, right? Is finishing songs. So The Art of Mr. Bill is kind of like, it kind of like I have all the tricks that I would normally sort of do in all of my tutorials and stuff, but it's like, here's how I would like implement them all into making a song. But the latest series is the one I suggest because it's like the most digestible one. It's filmed really nicely, and The Art of Mr. Bill Season 4 is also filmed really nicely, but the three before that are just me and my webcam. And up until Season 4, all of the videos were 1 hour long, and 1 hour is just a long time to watch a video for. So instead of doing like 10 1 hour videos, I did 35 20 minute videos. So they're all
nice. Yeah. Yeah, you know, just like, yeah, in those here's how you make that weird sound, those are useful. But, you know, just like the way you organize your stems, you know, like stuff like that, like for people like me is really useful. You know, it's like seeing the way you're breaking up. You know, I up until watching your tutorials, I was like, I was just putting all the drums in the same stem, you know what I mean, like not putting the kicks and the snares and everything in separate stems, and now it's like holy fuck,
yeah, makes
man,
sense.
The difference. Yeah,
so another thing that helped me a lot when I was first starting is to see like what a finished project file looks like, which is why I give those away on my website too. There's like 50 of them on there now. And like, basically you can download them and look through them, and you can do whatever you want with them. You can remix them or do whatever, but that's not really the point of them. The point is just to like download it and just be like, all right, this is what a finished song looks like when it's done.
But what if, I'm sorry, what if people don't have the plugins? Like what if
I freeze, download one of them? I freeze everything. So,
cool. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I also like put lessons in them. So like down in the sidebar in Ableton, there's like a bunch of notes about the project. Like here's what this thing is for, and this is what this does. And, when I first got started, like seeing a finished project file, just like made shit make a lot more sense to me. to be like, oh, this is what all of those tricks combine into at the end.
Right.
But yeah, so that's kind of the premise of the website. There's also like, I put every live stream I've ever done up there, which is like thousands of hours at this point. Like, I don't expect anyone to go through all of that. And then I've got like 20 sample packs on there as well. So like, basically they're sort of like the building blocks that you can use for making all of your own beats and stuff. Though I also have videos up there of, as to how I make my sample packs as well, in case people want to make their own personal samples and just use those.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your music. And what's the festival you're headed towards, in case people want to come?
It's called Lost Lands. And yeah, it's by Excision. It's his festival.
Thank you, Bill. Hare Krishna. I'll see you next time.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me.
That was Mr. Bill, everybody. Again, it's MrBillsTunes.com. You can find the links at DuncanTrussell.com. Much thanks to our wonderful sponsors. I hope that you will try them out. Much thanks to you for listening. I'll see you out there.